bill we're going to deal with is a public hearing on Senate Bill 100. And I'm assuming, is it Philip Schindel or Schrader? I'm sorry.
Schrader.
I perceive you should have been a physician.
Oh, I know. I got stuck with that one the other day. You're going to give it to Ted?
Okay. If you, when you're ready, just state your name for the record and speak.
Chair Minnis, members of the committee, my name's Philip Schradl, special counsel to the Attorney General. And I've asked Steve Bouchon and Sue Oliver to also accompany me. I thought it would be more efficient and effective for the committee's consideration if we did it as a panel. I'll let them introduce themselves for the record.
All right.
Chairman Minnis, members of the committee, I'm Steve Bouchon. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm also the attorney in charge of the special litigation unit of the trial division of the Department of Justice.
Thank you.
Chairman Minnis, members of the committee, my name is Sue Oliver. I'm a senior hazardous waste specialist with the Department of Environmental Quality.
All right, great. So who's going to proceed?
Chairman Minnis, I will. I do have a housekeeping matter just at the beginning. I hope that all of the committee members, and I understand they do, have the -3 amendments. That incorporates into this bill the proposal that we'd actually like to submit for the committee's consideration. What I intend to do is give you kind of a brief overview of what was perceived to be the problem and the approach that we've taken to address it. In the world of administrative law, under Oregon's Administrative Procedures Act, there are matters that have an entitlement by statute or by constitution to contested case proceedings, and there's a whole range of other actions that state agencies take. Those are called orders in other than contested cases. The line of demarcation is this legislature has already determined in a number of instances when people are entitled to contested case kinds of proceedings before a government unit like a state agency can act. The legislature has also made the determination that with respect to a variety of other kinds of actions, there is no entitlement to a contested case before the government unit acts. This bill does not touch upon contested case proceedings or change the processes that are associated with contested case proceedings at all. This bill is designed to deal with and try and create an effective mechanism to deal with evidentiary matters in other than contested case proceedings. Under the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act, those contested cases go directly on review to the Court of Appeals. Other than contested cases go to the circuit court. So the starting point is that the legislature has already determined in a number of instances those kinds of matters for which contested case proceedings are not required. Under current law, when those orders go on review to the circuit court, there are now, by virtue of the Oregon Supreme Court's interpretation of the Administrative Procedures Act in a case called Norden that is set out in the testimony, has determined that they are then entitled to a trial-type proceeding in the circuit court on review of those kinds of agency orders. We take issue with that, thinking that that is an overly costly and unnecessary step, and what we've attempted to do is to make a more cost-effective approach by way of, and let me run through the steps of what we have attempted to set out for you by our amendments. What we are trying to do is to encourage people, and here I think I'll take one step back, because agency orders in other than contested cases cover a very, very, very broad range of actions. It covers everything from a letter that somebody might receive where there has not been a proceeding before, to something that might have a very involved proceeding before. And one of the matters that we'll touch upon is gas versus Department of Environmental Quality case. So in those circumstances, sometimes you will have just simply a notification from the agency that an action is being contemplated. You currently have 60 days to seek judicial review. What we would like to set up is a mechanism whereby during that 60-day window of opportunity, if you have additional information, if you have any evidence that you would like the agency to consider, that you present that to the agency, and the agency needs to provide you with a reasonable opportunity to consider that evidence. And then when they do so, that's part of the record that then goes up before the circuit court on judicial review. There may be circumstances where evidence might come to light later, after you've sought judicial review. We've attempted to address that circumstance as well by saying as long as there were good and substantial reasons why you didn't present it to the agency, and that would include the fact that it came to light or that you learned of it after you sought judicial review, that you'd still have the opportunity to do that. And here we think it's much more cost-effective and efficient and effective if, in the first instance, that matter then would be sent to the agency to consider that additional evidence. Because under the current regime, when the reviewing court takes evidence that the agency never saw and never had an opportunity to consider, what happens is you have a reviewing court sitting there making judgment about whether an agency action was substantiated well enough, a correct action, on evidence that the agency never had before it to consider. So we are trying to do two things. We're trying to encourage matters to be handled in a less costly, quicker time frame by dealing with it at the agency level, and set up administrative law review in a way that we really think it's supposed to work, to have the reviewing court reviewing an agency action based upon what the agency had before it. So those two pieces of the mechanism are very significant and substantial. And what we currently have is a regime whereby every time that any one of these kinds of actions is challenged, whether it's simply a letter and the only thing that the person wants to do is to submit a letter to the agency in response, that nevertheless triggers a filing in circuit court and the engagement of the judicial process and a trial type proceeding that is costly and ineffective.
Senator Ringo.
Phil, thanks for coming this morning. Could you give us some context, please? I would find it useful if you could give some examples of what are the most common types of orders other than in a contested case where this might apply.
Well, Senator Ringo, one of the examples that we'll be talking about in a little bit are permitting processes.
This is the next witness who was going to give me the context. Sorry.
To some extent. But currently, in many circumstances, the person whose permit is at issue has an entitlement to a contested case proceeding if their application is denied. There could be a variety of other people out there in the world who might think, oh, the granting of the permit to that person is inappropriate as well. They don't have a statutory entitlement, nor do they have a constitutional entitlement to a contested case hearing to challenge that. That, for them, a permit challenge like that, when a granting of a permit, would be an order other than a contested case. But an order in other than a contested case can take a variety of forms. We, for example, in our office, cover telephone call inquiries about complaints, for example, that might lead to a complaint of a consumer problem. If we respond in writing by saying, thank you very much for your telephone call, we received your complaint, but it doesn't fit the matters for which we are charged with investigating, consequently, we're not going to take any further action with respect to that complaint, that is an order other than a contested case. And we generate probably thousands of those kinds of responses every year. The range is enormous, and it is virtually everything that agencies do, particularly in writing, that is not in a contested case setting. The range is rather enormous.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, continue.
Just to use that example, but follow through with me how this would end up in court then. So somebody sends a complaint, let's say a consumer issue. State sends a letter back saying, sorry, we can't help you. Then what happens there? Then the consumer says, says you have to help me, and then and files a lawsuit against the state.
Chairman, as Senator Ringo, the next step for that person would be to file a petition for judicial review in circuit court if they wanted to challenge the determination not to trigger an investigation. Unlikely that somebody might do that, but it certainly is, the vehicle is there. That's the mechanism that currently would work. And in order to get any information to the agency beyond that, that's the process that would be in place right now to do that. So consequently, I mean, what we're trying to do here is to make a very cost-effective approach, but I do want to reiterate that in no way are we attempting to forestall anybody from the opportunity of having an opportunity to present any evidence that they want to, for consideration by the agency. In fact, I mean, in the bill itself, you know, after seeking judicial review, if somebody has something that they need to or want to present, the court dictates what kind of process the agency should afford if they send it back to the agency. The bill provides that. The court shall authorize and may require that the agency receive the additional evidence upon such conditions as the court determines necessary and appropriate. We're not here trying to keep somebody from not being able to present additional evidence. We think it's much more effective and efficient if it's presented to the agency in the first instance so that the court can actually serve its review function. Before I pass it on...
Has a question.
Could there be a case where the evidence is presented to the agency and the agency, for whatever reasons, decides not to make it part of the record? Does the agency have discretion on whether to make it part of the record?
Chairman, as Senator Burdick, no. The agency is required to forward the record that they had before them onto the circuit court. In fact, I think it's the record requirement is that within 30 days of the petition for judicial review, they are required to transmit the record.
But there's no, to follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, of course.
There's no provision for the agency to say this evidence is irrelevant, we're not making this part of the record.
Chairman, as Senator Burdick, I think the mechanism that would be used, if an agency were presented with evidence that it didn't consider that it was material or relevant to the issues at all, it would make that determination, but then when it transmitted the record to the court, it would transmit that evidence along with it so that the reviewing court could determine whether the agency correctly determined that it was irrelevant or whatever, for whatever reason, wasn't considered.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. The last comment that I want to make sure to add is that I submitted our proposal to Brad Swank with the Judicial Department, and the Judicial Department believes that this is an improvement in the circumstance as well, and they support the proposal.
All right. Thank you very much. Sir?
Good morning, Chair, Minutes, members of the committee. As I said before, I'm Steve Bushong from the Department of Justice. I'm with the Trial Division, and I'm here to give you a trial lawyer's perspective of how current law works in practice and how we think the law would work under the bill if it's enacted. And first, in order to get a feel for how we think this bill is a cost-saving measure for the state, and in order to understand that, I'm just going to quickly run through some of the trial costs that are incurred by the state when a matter is brought in circuit court, which is what happens under current law. Of course, you have the costs of the Department of Justice attorney, paralegal staff in preparing the case for trial. You have the agency costs, which can be very significant in preparing the case for trial. When the case goes to trial, of course, you have to have a Department of Justice attorney is there actually trying the case. Often you need an agency representative because some of these matters, when they go to trial, are very complex technically, factually, and the assistance of the agency is frequently required when you're defending the state's interests. Agency representatives are often witnesses at trial, and this can take a substantial amount of their time preparing for and testifying at trial. And then the last piece that I put on my written testimony that I think is important is the judicial resources. Trials in circuit court take time, and they can take a lot of time, as I'll get to in a moment. And the courts are swamped. Circuit courts in Oregon have lots of matters on their docket, and to have them using their resources on review of agency decisions and hearing witness testimony that could be presented to the agency in the first instance, and evidence that could and should be presented to the agency first, is a commitment of judicial resources. So those things are things to keep in mind. The first example I wanted to give you is before the Norden case, as Mr. Schradl testified to, how the law worked. Norden was decided in year 2000 by the Oregon Supreme Court. Before that time, I had a case, and my examples are all cases that I've handled, so I have some familiarity with them. GASP versus the Environmental Quality Commission and the Department of Environmental Quality. It was a big case. The DEQ and EQC issued a permit to the United States Army to build and operate an incineration facility out in Umatilla to destroy the chemical weapons stockpile that's out there. Third parties to the permit wanted to challenge that, as they're entitled to under the law. They filed their challenge in circuit court. The agency decision to issue the permit was issued in other than a contested case process. It was a very public process, involved lots of public testimony. A voluminous agency record was compiled, and then the decision was challenged in circuit court. Well, when we got to court, the way the matter was handled, the agency compiled the record. We submitted the entire record to the circuit court. The people challenging the permitting decision submitted their arguments. They basically argued from the record that the agency should have made a different decision and not issued the permit. That's what the hearing was all about. And the court decided the matter on summary judgment. And there was just a hearing. It lasted a day in court, and the court decided the legal issues, the legal propriety of the permitting decision, and whether the evidence that was before the agency supported the agency decision, and the court considered all the evidence. That hearing lasted one day, didn't take any testimony because the record was there. And that was decided before the Norden decision came down from the Oregon Supreme Court. After Norden, we have GASP round three, which that was round two, which involved a minor issue that I didn't want to take the time to discuss. Round three was the same circumstance, the Umatilla incineration facility. Round three involved the agency's decision not to revoke the permit that it had previously issued. And it's not uncommon that people who feel strongly about an issue, as these petitioners did and do, they brought it back before the agency and said, you know, there's new circumstances, new things you should consider, and we'd like you to revoke this permit. The agency considered that new evidence, held more public hearings, created a new record relating to the request to revoke the permit, and decided not to revoke the permit. That decision then was challenged, was subject to judicial review in circuit court because it was not a contested case decision. And that case now is under the Norden process, which is another way of handling judicial review of other than contested cases. Well, under Norden, the petitioners are now entitled to present all of their evidence to the circuit court, and we have a trial. In fact, I'm in the middle of the trial. The trial started in November. We took 5 weeks, and it didn't finish then. We had to adjourn because of the court process, the court docket, and we're now continuing the trial 3 more weeks in March. This is the third week. I have to go back this afternoon. There was no witness available this morning. But that's 8 weeks of trial time, and all indications are we will not finish. There will be more. So that does take resources. I'm not saying this is a terrible way to do things, but it does take resources. It takes the resources from the state's perspective, both the Department of Justice and the agency resources. It takes the resources of the parties who are preparing their case and presenting it to the court. I gave you another example after Norden because I wanted to. I think the Umatilla incinerator case may be an extreme example because it is a big case, and so I wanted to give you perhaps the other end of the extreme so you know the variety of circumstances that can come to court in this circumstance. The example is Powell versus Bunn was a case that I handled at the circuit court level. That was basically a decision to challenge the decision issued by the Department of Education that the Portland School District had a policy that allowed the Boy Scouts of America to come into the schools and make presentations to recruit new members. That policy was challenged by a student who was an atheist, alleging that the Boy Scouts were a religious organization and that the Portland School District, by allowing the presentation in the schools, was violating this student's religious, was discriminating on account of his religion against this student. Again, under Norton, this was an order, the decision by the Department of Education that basically approved the school district policy was not in a contested case process. So challenging that decision would be filed in circuit court, as it was. And we went to trial under Norton because the plaintiffs had the right to go to trial. The trial in that case lasted only one day, and there's a reason for that. The reason it lasted one day is we were able to stipulate the attorneys working out an agreement with the other side and with the lawyers for the school district. We were able to stipulate to most of the facts. There was some witness testimony. Actually, the student got on the stand and testified. But that lasted a day. Now, that can happen. And in some of these cases, there is a wide variety of agency orders that can be challenged in circuit court under the Administrative Procedures Act. On the one extreme, we have the GASP, the Umatilla example, that can take weeks. On the other extreme, we have the Boy Scouts Portland School District case that can be handled in a day. I would expect that there are cases that will be anywhere in between. Some may last even longer. The question I think that our bill presents for you is whether or not this process is the process, is an efficient use of resources for resolving questions of reviewing agency decisions. Do we want to have this process? Do we want to commit the resources to reviewing agency decisions in this way? My suggestion is that the Norton procedure is costly. I think that's a fact. We have to acknowledge that it is costly to go to court in every one of these instances, and that the procedure in Senate Bill 100 provides for a fair opportunity to present evidence, have that evidence considered by the agency, and then ultimately have the agency decision reviewed by the court and all of the evidence reviewed by the court, but without incurring the substantial costs of the trials in circuit court that we're seeing.
Chairman?
Yes, Senator Brady.
For background, what happens during a contested case hearing? And who gets to request that?
Chairman Minnis, Senator Burdick, a contested case hearing arises when a particular statute or the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution requires that there be a contested case hearing. And in those circumstances, there is a hearing that is like a trial, but is before an agency decision maker or, in most cases, before an administrative law judge. And then that decision would be subject to appeal to the Oregon Court of Appeals. That's a different process. This bill doesn't address that process at all. It leaves
in
place.
I understand that, but you mentioned this GASP case with the Umatilla. That's a huge case involving public interest just as much as many contested, probably more than many contested case hearings would. And I'm just wondering if there's any process, if you considered in this bill providing some avenue for people who don't now have standing to request a contested case hearing to get standing under some circumstances to create a record before an administrative law judge. Have you considered that as a possible approach?
Chairman, Senator Burdick, and I'm going to ask Mr. Schradl to respond to this as well. I'll give you my answer. It's my understanding that was considered, and we decided because Oregon law in a number of different statutes establishes the right to a contested case hearing, and instead of trying to address that whole scheme of statutory provisions in one bill, we thought it would be best to leave existing law in place on when there would be a contested case. The legislature can change that whenever it wants to with respect to any particular process. But we thought that would be the best result, and only have this bill address the process for reviewing those categories of cases that by law do not require a contested case.
Because, Mr. Chairman, when you take a major matter like that, I think the argument could be made that, you know, that information you're likely to get out of a contested case hearing where both sides are in there, you know, advocating for their point of view is going to be a different record than just simply a receptacle of information from one side of the issue.
Chairman, Senator Burdick, I think you're right. It would be a different type of record because you go through the formal process and creating a record with testimony and cross-examination. And in this instance, in the Gaspin instance that I gave you, as you'll hear from Ms. Oliver, there was a process in which, a public process in which concerned citizens were able to present testimony to the agency decision makers, but it wasn't contested case process because that takes a lot longer and that takes a lot of resources as well.
And Mr. Chairman, final follow-up. If there had been a contested case process involved in that gas case, for example, do you think that would have saved money having it in that context rather than in a circuit court context?
Chair Minnis, Senator Burdick, I don't have the figures for that. You could make an argument either way, frankly, that it would or would not have saved money. I'll lay out my answers for you. The argument that it would save money is that instead of going to the court process that we're going through right now in GASP, that same process would be happening before an administrative law judge. Does that save money? Well, it certainly saves the judicial resources. We wouldn't have that incurred, but at the same time, we would be incurring the cost of going through the same process before an administrative law judge, and then it would be subject to an appeal directly to the Oregon Court of Appeals. As it stands now, the current case will be subject to an appeal to the Oregon Court of Appeals, so that's probably a wash. My experience with agencies presenting matters in contested cases is that the witness preparation, the witness time, the agency commitment of resources is similar, so I don't think there would have been that much of a savings there. I think I've answered that question.
Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. Just one last question.
Sure.
Since you work in this area, how many times has this come up where these other than contested cases go to circuit court? Is this a frequent occurrence or a rare occurrence?
Chairman, Senator Burdick, my experience has been that it is, and I don't have statistics to back this up. I can just give you where I'm coming from. I'm as attorney in charge of the special litigation unit. I get specially selected cases of significance to the state to handle. My cases involve things like GASP. I was a trial attorney for the PERS case, which I know is everyone's heard about Judge Lipscomb's decision. That actually was a review of a order in other than a contested case, and we tried that case. My cases are so typically big, so I don't have all of the examples, but I do get things like the Boy Scouts case. I've had other instances in which, and other attorneys in my unit, where we've had judicial review of orders in other than contested cases. I think that they're more common. The trials are more common in our commercial and environmental unit, where there are permits issued by a permitting agency like DEQ, or other licenses, or in some instances a contract is granted, and a third party to either the permit or the contract opposes it for whatever reason, and there are, the reasons run the gamut. Those are fairly common. I don't have numbers to back that up, but they are fairly common occurrences. Certainly, we do have a fair number of trials on those types of matters.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the PERS case, a lot of information came out of that contested case hearing, and that led to a very significant decision, whether you're for it or against it, at the state level. And that, you know, that's been my concern with this all along, is in the major cases where there's major policy involved, whether you're going to get the kind of parsed out decision that you would get in a contested type hearing, or it's you know, it's kind of twin in the circuit court process. You know, I can see it in some ways for the very, very minor things where the record is pretty straightforward. But in cases like PERS and the gas case, there's information that could very well never emerge without that basically conflict situation of a contested case hearing or a circuit court trial. Have you thought about ways to address that? How would you see that being addressed in this bill?
Chair Minnis, Senator Burdick, I think that does happen and actually did happen before Norden, before we had to have the facts fleshed out in a circuit court trial. They are fleshed out before the agency. Parties submit evidence to agencies all the time on all sides of the issue. And then when the agency record is submitted to the circuit court for review, it's an adversarial process. The GASP-1, my first example, is a good example of that. The positions of the parties and the evidence supporting all sides of the issue were fleshed out in detail in the summary judgment hearing that was held before the circuit court. The difference being that the testimony of the witnesses before the court was not required. And you can make an argument whether that would be a good thing or bad thing, whether you should do that. All I'm saying is that as requiring that in every instance is a significant commitment of resources. My experience has been that in the Umatilla situation, PERS is also another example. Almost all of those facts, actually all of the facts, were gathered by the agency and submitted to the court. The hearing process that we had in Judge Lipscomb's court in that case fleshed out the facts that were already facts of record. And that could have been done with or without witness testimony. I think the court would have gotten to the exact same place it got. I don't have any problem with that.
Wait a second. Are you saying that if this had gone to an appellate court, that Judge Lipscomb's recommendations was that money be restored money be taken out of accounts because of past board decisions, money be taken out of accounts and put back into the PERS rainy day fund or whatever they call it. Are you saying that an appellate court could have reached that level of decision making?
Chairman of Senator Burdick, no, I'm not saying that, because in the PERS instance, the review would still be before the circuit court. Judge Lipscomb still would have been reviewing the same evidence that he reviewed in this instance. All I'm saying is that the process for review under Senate Bill 100, the process would have been looking at the agency record and making a decision based on the arguments of the parties. And under Norden, that process also involved the testimony of witnesses at trial. Frankly, the matter that you mentioned, the placing of funds in the contingency reserve at PERS, was actually Judge Lipscomb decided that issue on summary judgment. So he didn't need the testimony of witnesses to reach that conclusion.
Thank you.
Mr.
Chair? Senator Ringo.
Steve, could you comment for a moment on what the difference is in terms of discovery opportunities? You know, when you're in circuit court, you have the ability to take depositions, issue subpoenas, third parties. What are the opportunities to gather that kind of evidence before an agency?
Chairman, Senator Ringo, when a petition for review is filed in circuit court, that triggers the normal discovery rules that apply to any circuit court proceeding. I don't think there's anything in this bill that would prevent any party from asking for discovery of either the agency. Depositions could be requested. Now, whether or not they'd be required is something for the court to decide in each instance.
You're talking about once the case is in circuit court.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
And that would be the case under Senate Bill 100. The case would still be filed in circuit court.
Okay. To the extent the decision is made at the agency level, then there is not the right to issue a subpoena to third parties, for example. Is that right?
Chair Minnis, Senator Ringo, I think that is right. I think the subpoenaing process at the agency level comes up, and it's discretionary for the agency when there is a contested case. In this instance, we're talking about review when there is no contested case process required by law.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Finished. Where are we going from here?
Thank you. Ms. Oliver now has some testimony.
All right, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Minnis, members of the committee. As mentioned previously, I'm Sue Oliver with the Department of Environmental Quality. The department supports Senate Bill 100. We are currently overseeing 3,000 permits and orders in other than a contested case. Some of these are issued under federally delegated environmental permit programs, such as the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, or Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. Others are issued under state-only environmental programs. Timely permit review and action are essential to protecting human health and the environment, while at the same time facilitating economic development and regulatory streamlining. The procedures for issuing DEQ permits vary based on the kind of permit and its environmental significance. Generally, however, the agency develops a detailed administrative record to support its decision. It is our understanding that under Norton, a person challenging a DEQ permitting decision who does not receive a contested case hearing before the agency would be entitled to a trial in the circuit court. Fortunately, relatively few DEQ permits or orders have been challenged, but the Norton decision is expected to have a serious impact in those cases where challenges by third parties do occur. We've heard discussion this morning of the GASP 3 case. This case involved a challenge to the hazardous waste and air quality permits issued for the chemical weapons incinerator located near Umatilla. The plaintiffs are citizens and organizations that are opposed to incineration technology. They've invoked Norton to obtain a full trial in the circuit court, despite the fact that the agency had already developed an extensive administrative record and fully considered their testimony before deciding that incineration of the deteriorating chemical weapons at Umatilla do not pose an adverse effect on either human health or the environment. As Mr. Bouchong mentioned, the gas trial has so far taken almost 8 weeks. The DEQ estimates its expenses in this single trial will be approximately $126,000. That is growing if the trial is extended once again. The gas trial may be an extreme example, but the DEQ often issues controversial permits that are opposed by third parties. Costs could be significant to this agency if we have to deal with third-party challenges to even a small fraction of the permits that we issue. Of the 3,000 permits and orders I mentioned earlier, approximately 600 could be considered major and would likely be subject to review under Norton. Assuming that about 120 of these permits would be active during the next biennium and that 25% would be contested, we could have up to 30 cases during the biennium that would go to trial in the circuit court. If each case costs only one quarter of what the gas trial is costing, the department is looking at expenses of approximately $945,000. DEQ supports Senate Bill 100 with the proposed amendments. The bill clarifies the procedures and agency responsibilities with respect to the agency and judicial review of other than contested case orders. The proposed legislation defines the process by which a person could submit additional evidence for the agency to consider in its decision-making process, while at the same time preserving the third party's ability to obtain judicial review if the party is still not satisfied with the agency decision. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Oliver. Any questions, Ms. Oliver? There are none. Thank you. We've got some other witnesses I want to get on.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Milton Jones. Jones, could you just state your name for the record and proceed?
Yes, my name is Milton Jones. I'm an attorney with Perkins Coie in Portland. I'm here representing myself as an attorney who practices administrative law, primarily before the DEQ, but also before other agencies. I'm also representing Associated Oregon Industries this morning. John Ledger was called away because of illness in his family. The previous witnesses from the state, I think, concentrated primarily on from the deficiencies to be achieved by Senate Bill 100. I would also like to add that in addition to the deficiencies, Senate Bill 100 is really good administrative law. In Oregon, broadly speaking, cases are divided into contested cases and other than contested cases. The other than contested cases is really a default bucket into which agency decisions fall if they are not contested cases. And typical examples of other than contested cases include, as they said, taking no action on a nuisance complaint, denying permit issuance challenge by a third party, where to hold public meetings, what flavor of cake to have at a conference. If it's not a contested case, it is an other than contested case decision. In February of 2000, the Oregon Supreme Court, in Norden versus Water Resources Department, interpreted the current statutes to require courts reviewing appeals of agency decisions in other than contested cases to provide petitioning parties with an opportunity to make a record like the one they would have in a contested case proceeding, but to have that opportunity in front of the circuit court. As they said, a contested case proceeding involves a discovery, subpoena powers, cross-examination of witnesses, and these protections are provided because typically in a contested case proceeding, the subject matter involves determinations of individual rights or privileges or duties of such significance that the higher degree of protection is required. And that's the way your statutes are framed. Today, you've categorized, you have listed a number you have listed as a broad category that a requirement that contested cases will be held under those circumstances, and that other than contested cases will be held in circumstances that where these types of individual rights, privileges, and duties are not at issue. The result of Norden is really that persistent petitioners have rights on appeal to make a case using the full-fledged contested case procedures in all controversies, except, of course, rulemakings where setting the rulemaking process aside. In a sense, the Norden decision has stood administrative law on its head in two respects. The first one is that instead of having information placed in front of an agency and having the issues fleshed out in front of the agency, it's very often the case now, or it is often the case now, that material the agency has never heard or considered, evidence the agency has never heard or considered, is brought to the circuit court. The circuit court at that point is stepping into the shoes of the agency, trying to make an agency-like decision. This is particularly difficult for circuit court judges when the matters involved are technical in nature. For example, in the case of DEQ, a decision about whether or not to incinerate chemical weapons at Umatilla involves a tremendous amount of technical expertise, which the agency has. The court does not have this information, does not have that expertise, and yet the court is in the position, as a result of Norden, of hearing evidence for the first time on these very technical issues and making a decision concerning them without the benefit of the agency's of previous review. What Senate Bill 100 would do is it would require the record to be made in front of the agency, a decision made by the agency with utilizing their expertise, and then having had that decision made, it would go to the court where the court would perform its review on appeal. And the appellate review at that point is the appropriate review for the court to make. It is not stepping into the shoes of the agency. It is instead reviewing the record that the agency has made, and it will have the advantage of the agency's decision and the agency's expertise on all of the evidence that went into making the agency decision. One of the pernicious effects of the Norden decision, and one of the things that Senate Bill 100 corrects in this regard, is that petitioners can sandbag the agency under the current situation. They go in, they go in front of the agency, they do not present all of the evidence they have. because they know that once an agency decision is made, they will be in front of the circuit court with an opportunity to present evidence that they have withheld from the agency. And if they feel that they will have a better opportunity to get a positive decision from the court than from the agency, they're in a position to do that. This places, as I said, the circuit court judges in a terrible position because they are essentially stepping into the shoes of the agency and performing an agency function at that point.
Senator Ringo.
Mr. Jones, in these disputes, or that I assume that the trier of fact, the administrative law judge is making factual determinations, and that if this were in the circuit court level, then at that point, obviously, the judge is the one that would be making the factual determinations. I mean, is that that's correct?
Yes. If I understand your question, yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a obviously the record can go on up to the appellate level, but at some point there's got to be some factual determinations based on the evidence submitted, and I'm just wondering whether there are circumstances where all on environmental issues, just as an example, where the public would think that somebody in an agency has a certain bias that a circuit court judge would not have in arriving at certain factual determinations.
That's possible, and I think that's why a person would withhold information from the agency, hoping to get a better shot at their question in front of the circuit court. But again, that places the circuit court judge in a terrible position because they are dealing with issues for which they have no expertise at that juncture. The appropriate approach in administrative law is to have a decision by the agency and then have the court review that decision based and apply to that decision the standards that the legislature has set for agency decisions, which is that they be supported by the record. They be in conformance with the law and supported by the record. That's the standard of review and appeal. As opposed to stepping into the shoes of the agency and hearing brand new information and trying to make a determination about it at the outset.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What is the standard for reviewing factual errors, at the appellate level? I mean, must there be clear error, or what's that? Since I don't do administrative law.
Right. I believe that the standard for review by the appellate court is whether or not the decision of the agency was supported by the record. I do not recall whether or not the court is allowed to reverse findings of fact, but they can remand to the agency for additional findings.
I see. I just want to understand the process a little better. I mean, if we're in an administrative hearing, the administrative law judge will make written findings of fact.
Yes.
And those findings of fact will be accepted at the appellate level unless they're not supported by the evidence. I mean, they're not absolutely accepted as correct, are they?
The findings of fact by an agency have to be supported by the record. That's correct. If it's not supported by the record, that's grounds for reversal.
All right. So at the appellate level, the court could say that they're not going to accept the findings of fact because they're just not supported.
They could say that the decision of the agency flies in the face of the facts, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And then at that point, they would remand it probably to the agency
Are you finished?
Yeah, I am. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Brady, could you?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I used to deal a little bit with the Administrative Procedure Act at the federal level, and the standard there was arbitrary and capricious for overturning an agency decision. And that was a very high standard. Do you happen to know whether the Oregon standard is the same?
I believe the Oregon standard is whether or not the decision of the agency is supported by the records and in conformance with the law. And that which is a little different than the arbitrary and capricious.
It's a lower bar than arbitrary and capricious.
Sounds like saying the same thing. It's either supported by the facts or it's not supported by the facts. Arbitrary and capricious wouldn't have any facts supporting it, you would think.
Yeah,
it's like making a decision in the absence of
that.
I'm not a lawyer either.
I would tend to think that the Oregon standard is a higher standard. You would have to have facts that support it as opposed to You have to have a record that, which supports your decision.
Well, I was misspeaking. What I'm saying is that in the Oregon standard, it would be easier to overturn an agency decision than it would be at the federal level, where you have to show that the agency was arbitrary and capricious.
I believe that's correct, yes.
Thank you.
All right. Are you finished?
I just wanted to make maybe the most important point in my entire testimony, or the notes at the end. Unless you believe that contested case procedures must be available for review in every case, Senate Bill 100 is not about when a contested case is available. That is a decision that's made in other parts of the statutes, and you may want to revisit that at some point. There are many attorneys who believe that decisions are made that should have contested cases, but where they're not required under current law. And that is something which you can revisit, but it is not dealt with Senate Bill 100. What Senate Bill 100 deals with is appellate review of agency decisions that have been determined not to require a contested case. And I think that distinction is important.
All right. Thank you very much. Is it Janice Karayam? I can't quite read your writing. Sorry. Came off, walked in the room, and half the committee leaves. If you would just state your name for the record.
My name is Janice Krem. I'm an attorney. I practice administrative law exclusively. I'd like to thank you for allowing the administrative law section of the Oregon State Bar to testify about its concerns about Senate Bill 100 and the Dash 3 amendments. A little bit about the administrative law section. We have approximately 250 members, slightly less. In order to promote a balanced perspective on administrative law issues, our executive committee, as well as the committee that I chair, which is the Legislation and Rules Committee, they're composed of lawyers who are both in the private sector as well as employed by state government. As you probably heard, under the APA, there are certain cases where the agency is required to create a record in a contested case hearing. In other cases, and the agency can decide whether it wants to hold a contested case hearing. If it chooses to conduct a contested case hearing, then that's the record on appeal. It does not go to the circuit court. It goes, if people are dissatisfied with the decision of the agency, that record would then go to the Court of Appeals. If they decide that they don't want to hold a hearing, then the law provides that you get a hearing in the circuit court. When we look at the Gasp case, the reason the Gasp case was in the circuit court for a prolonged proceeding before the circuit court is because that agency chose not to give a contested case hearing. If that agency had chosen to give a contested case hearing, that hearing would have been handled in the agency proceeding. It would have been handled by a contested case hearing. That record would have been the record that was could be appealed, and that record would then go to the Court of Appeals. There would be no circuit court review. What exactly happens in a contested case hearing? As everybody has said, it's very similar to a trial, but I can assure you it is far less formal than a circuit court proceeding. The APA, Administrative Procedures Act, if you don't mind, I'll just call it the APA. If that offends you, I'll try to remind myself to say it correctly. Under the APA, when you have a contested case hearing, it's really geared to assist people who are not represented by attorneys to participate fully in the agency's record development in its hearing. Now, for those of us who represent clients who hire us, we don't care how complicated those hearings are. The more complicated, the better. But the section, the administrative law section, supports the notion that the legislature has already set forth in the Administrative Procedures Act that these proceedings should be available to unrepresented people. The agency should not have to go out and hire a lawyer to go to circuit court. Parties who are dissatisfied, people who are affected by an agency order, shouldn't have to go to the circuit court to get review. The section supports the idea of there being a contested case hearing where people can fully participate, which is what the contested case hearing does. Now, the thing about a contested case hearing, I have to tell you, my background is as an administrative law judge. I have conducted many, many, many contested case hearings. Some of those hearings are very simple. The process that, that a contested case hearing provides is very flexible. It's very easy to use. And I have conducted hearings where the entire hearing process, where I was taking information and trying to understand the party's position, consisted of a 5-minute telephone hearing. That was the contested case hearing in terms of creating the record. On the other hand, I have been dealing with contested case hearings where there are multiple parties, multiple issues, difficult cases, and that contested case proceeding lasted for multiple days. A contested case hearing is very flexible. It can give the parties whatever they need. And who decides how long that hearing should be, what evidence gets into the record, makes the rulings on whether somebody can or can't subpoena somebody, how long the testimony could be, who can get cross-examination, all those decisions, how that record is developed, how an unexperienced person is able to explain their position with the help of an administrative law judge, all of that is done in a contested case hearing with the help of an impartial administrative law judge. The Thomas Ewing, who is the chief administrative law judge of the hearing officer panel, recently gave testimony to the House Judiciary Committee on the success of that panel. And just to let you realize how inexpensive, on the average, these hearings can be, the chief administrative law judge estimated that the average cost of a case that was referred to the hearing officer panel cost $277 in costs to the agency from the panel. Now, I say that's an average. A big hearing would obviously cost more, and a simple hearing, 5 minutes on a telephone, would cost less. But I wanted to give you an idea of the flexibility of the hearing, the impartiality of the hearing that's conducted by a hearing officer, administrative law judge, and the fact that this is a significantly cheaper process than going to the circuit court.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
Where do the administrative law judges come from in this case? Are they brought in from the outside?
The hearing officer panel applies to most agencies. So there are some agencies that are excluded. But for those agencies within a panel, those hearing officers are employed by the unemployment department. But they are not under the supervision and control of any agency. They're a panel that are supervised by the chief hearing officer. Some agencies that are not required to use a hearing officer panel, they have to go out and hire their own hearing officers. But the trend in Oregon is to centralize hearing officers, have a panel available to conduct these hearings who are not affiliated with the agency whose opinion or decision is being challenged by the parties. So it's an impartial, independent approach to who conducts these hearings now. And they are generally employed by the hearing officer panel. Just to give you an example of how the current system works, I guess I'll just turn your attention to maybe not the worst possible case, which is the gas case. I think I would perhaps turn your attention to a typical permitting case, which would like be the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The commission decides that it wants to issue a particular list liquor license. The city in which that liquor premises is established might have some concerns about all the extra costs that might go into policing what they see as a potentially bad licensed premises. Or they could have a problem with street drinking, and they don't want another convenience store selling fortified liquor in that community. Or there could be a neighbor, or a church, or a school who's being affected by that license. So they can go to the Liquor Control Commission and say, we would like a contested case hearing. And under the current standard that is in place right now under the Administrative Procedures Act, the agency could say, fine, we're giving you a hearing. Come on down. We're going to have an impartial process. And that's the record that would go up to the Court of Appeals if people were continue to be dissatisfied with that decision. On the other hand, the agency can say, we aren't going to give you a hearing. We don't want to create the record. We want you to go to the circuit court, and we want the court to have to create that record. And when they go to the circuit court would create the record because the agency declined to create it, and that record will be similar to what the agency would have created had it held a contested case
here. Can I ask you a question about your statement with respect to the intent of the agency? Because you implied that the agencies would intentionally send one of these cases to circuit court. My understanding of what you said was that the agency chooses not to have a contested case hearing, then the proceeding may occur in circuit court.
That's correct.
And are you suggesting that the agency intentionally moves these cases to circuit court?
I think that there's a variety of reasons why they would do that.
I'm sorry?
I think there's a variety of reasons, Mr. Chair, that
right,
they might
do that. I guess I'm attacking your implication that the agency intentionally would defer these cases to circuit court. It seems more appropriate that they would, if they chose not to have a contested case hearing, and that's the decision of the agency, then the persons who get this into circuit court, I assume, is the petitioner, correct? The person who's adversely affected by the agency's decision not
correct,
to have
sir.
A contested case hearing, correct? And all this bill would do then is if the person chose to move, or the agency decided not to have a contested case hearing, which according to current law puts it in circuit court, this would then require that the agency hold a contested case hearing, notwithstanding its decision to not hold a contested case hearing, correct?
If that's what it did, the section would support the bill. The bill does not do that.
All right.
In fact, the bill does exactly the opposite thing. It says you may not have a contested case hearing before the agency. And court, if you think they need further evidence, you may not direct them to give you a contested case hearing. That's the rub for our section.
All right.
Not that the agency couldn't create a hearing, create the record, but what kind of record? This bill says,
what you're saying right now doesn't track with me. I mean, right now, there's a number of these final orders. There is not a right to a contested case hearing right now.
That's correct. The agency can choose to give you one, and if it chooses not to, then your only avenue of relief is to go to the circuit court where you will get the equivalent of a contested case hearing.
Right, but I'm just focusing on what this bill does.
This bill says...
Could you let Senator Ringo ask the question,
I'm sorry.
Please.
It's okay. I apologize.
You want to make sure everybody has a right to a contested case hearing. I think you like that as a means for resolving disputes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I think it's an option. I think the section is open to an alternative, but the alternative offered by this bill does not offer enough due process and specificity to ensure that what you're getting in lieu of a contested case hearing will be an adequate way of developing a fair record.
Okay, well, right now we have a whole set of disputes that are resolving other than a contested case. Other than a contested case, correct? Yes.
Mr. Chair?
It was explained earlier, these things are divided into two parts.
I'm not really sure that I would say that's a really accurate description. There's a requirement that under some cases the agency has no choice but to give a hearing.
Right.
In all other cases, it can choose to give a hearing.
It seems to me that you're not satisfied with the current situation where sometimes there can be a final order without a contested case hearing. You're dissatisfied with that. And I guess my response is that this bill isn't intended to address that, really.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ring, you're correct. It doesn't address a proceeding that is enough like a contested case hearing to ensure that people have an adequate way to develop the record. This bill only provides the opportunity to present evidence to an agency. It doesn't give you an opportunity. You can have something other than a contested case hearing that would allow you to have cross-examination, discovery, an impartial hearing officer, the right to do that. But the question that this raises in one's mind then is, do you create a whole new process that ensures all the benefits of true record development? And then you have to start thinking about things like, okay, I can present evidence and I can cross-examine witnesses perhaps, but where does the subpoena power come from? because in the contested case hearing, it's automatic. It's easy. It's simple. You know it. If you create another process that isn't a contested case hearing and isn't a circuit court proceeding, and you create a new process, then you have to be very careful as how you create that process, because you've got to think about...
I don't think we're envisioning a whole new process. That's not what I was suggesting, but where was the administrative law section on this issue prior to the Norden case? We're here because the Norden case created the issue, and this bill is intended to address the Norden ruling.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, the Norden case simply expressed in an opinion what had always been the understanding of those of us who practice administrative law regularly was the status quo. The Norden case did not change.
Well, Ms. Krim, I guess I'm getting more confused by the minute, because what you're saying is completely contrary to the testimony offered by the Attorney General's office.
I'm going to exercise kind of some chairman-type decision control. Ms. Krim, I am not happy with the Oregon State Bar. I'm not happy with the fact that you signed up as being neutral, and reading your testimony, it indicates that your administrative law section does not support the bill. I'm not happy with the Oregon State Bar on a number of issues this session where they have changed their opinion or meddled into a decision or a bill in the middle of the discussion. And frankly, I'm not impressed with the Oregon State Bar this session. They've not done a good job of coordinating their work or dialoguing with the various parties, including the Attorney General's office. And I'm not impressed, because these issues should have been routed out early, and you should not have signed up as a neutral party when, in fact, your testimony indicates that you're not neutral. With that, I've got a number of other elected officials. I'm going to move on to public hearing on Senate Bill 617. Mr. Myers, Hardy Myers, you're present. I want to get you in and out of here, and I apologize for not getting you on earlier.
Sure. I'm hoping I'm available for the whole meeting. We have other members of the public.
All right. In that case, Senator Metzger, you're present. Senate Bill 487, with the public hearing, Senate Bill 47. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. And I'm glad to be able to join you today. I wasn't sure I was able to because of the committee, but we got our work done, so it's, I'm pleased to be here before you. Senate Bill 487 comes to us as a result of a meeting I had with a constituent this last year. And I will have Becky Hoffman, who's a deputy with the Hood River County Sheriff's Office, detail the specifics of this bill. But it does regard animal control officers and in pursuit of their official duties and the way they are treated under the law. And like many, many situations, we often find that we see flaws in the law only when an incident actually occurs. SB 487 will add animal control officers to the crime of assaulting a public safety officer. It makes no other changes to laws or policies related to animal control officers or public safety officers. And again, I introduced this legislation on Becky's behalf to help prevent an unfortunate situation from occurring in the future, and she will detail that. Becky puts herself in harm's way daily as a result of the work that she does in our community. I believe that Oregon law should reflect this risk and put protections in place for Becky and other animal control officers. And Mr. Chairman, if it be your desire, I would ask Ms. Hoffman to have an opportunity to explain her story, and then you'll understand 487.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Awesome.
And Mr. Chairman, I should real quickly, members of the committee, animal control officer means any person operating under the authority of this state, any unit of local government or the United States government, or pursuant to an agreement with any state, for the purpose of providing shelter and other care for lost, homeless, or injured animals, serving as an information center concerning missing and found animals, protecting the public from hazardous or unsanitary conditions associated with animals that are running at large, or protecting animals from neglect, cruelty, or abuse.
All right, thank you. Ms. Hoffman.
Chair Minnis and members of the committee, I'm Becky Hoffman. I live at 4153 Chandler Drive in beautiful Mount Hood, Oregon. And I've been a sheriff's deputy with Hood River County Sheriff's Department as the only animal control deputy for the entire county, which includes the town of Hood River and three smaller cities as well. I am delighted to be able to be here to talk to you about what 487 means to us, not only myself, but all other animal control officers in the state. I go to work every day wearing a uniform and a badge. Long gone is that vision that we all had of the little man with the net who chased dogs down Main Street, and that was your dog catcher. Thank heavens. Animal control officers today are educated professionals. We serve our communities by enforcing laws and regulations that are at the state and county level. We impound sick, stray, and injured animals, as well as holding possible rabid animals for quarantine, which is one of my least favorite things to do. Duties performed by animal control officers include investigating possible cruelty to animals. We answer all kinds of citizen complaints, catch stray, dangerous, or destructive animals. We also investigate livestock complaints, which will include theft, damage, death. We investigate neighborhood civil disputes and assist sheriff's deputies, city police officers, game units, as well as fire and rescue squads with animal-related calls. The contacts we make in a day often include drug dealers, animal abusers, people who abuse other people, animal hoarders, animal rights activists, and citizens who value their pets' lives far above ours. Our daily challenge is to leave a positive impression and educate each and every person that we come in contact with. Last December, I attended a week-long session of classes for animal control officers that was held at the University of Missouri in a law enforcement institute. There were approximately 30 officers in attendance, and well over a third had been assaulted in one way or another, including myself. In November of 2000, I responded to a simple barking dog complaint out at a rural address. The husband and wife were both home. They both came to the door. Well, within 30 seconds of the start of our conversation, they became so irate and so uncontrollable that I felt like the best thing to do was to try to leave. They were screaming and hollering at each other and at me about everything from neighbors that they felt were harassing them to not getting along with the Department of Agriculture, not liking the sheriff, and the intensity of their screaming. As they got madder and madder at each other, it overflowed onto me. And as I tried to leave the residence, I had them behind me, in front of me, in my ear, screaming, yelling, and they began telling me I wasn't going anywhere. As I got closer to my vehicle, the wife actually ran ahead, threw herself spread-eagled over my door, and began to tell me I wasn't going anywhere. And I'm thinking, first of all, who wants an animal control officer? Secondly, I can't believe this is happening. Refused to let me have my vehicle. I asked several times for her to remove herself from my vehicle. I asked her husband to help. His answer was begin to scream at me even louder, why didn't I just say? Well, then I'm thinking the reason they want me is because they have a hole dug in the backyard and they're just waiting to put an animal control officer in it. And I'm starting to get really concerned. I asked again several more times to please let me have my vehicle. I called on my portable radio for backup. And then she started hollering at me and telling me that you're still not going anywhere and no one is going to help you. There's not a sheriff, there's not a deputy, there's no one who's going to be able to help you. So I was beginning really to get quite frightened, and I reached at one point around behind her to see if I could pop my door open and bip her right off the door, and that was my big mistake. When I did that, she cut loose and hit me in the face so hard that it sent me sprawling backwards and spun me clear around. My face just immediately exploded in blood. And her husband, of course, started screaming, what have you done, what have you done? And she never stopped screaming about the neighbors and I'm not going anywhere. She never said, what have I done? Oh, my gosh. It was the strangest thing I've ever encountered. It was just amazing. I asked once more for my vehicle. I said, I'm holding my face. It's bleeding. You have to let me have my vehicle. I'm hurt. I have to leave. And she said no and stayed spread-eagled on my vehicle. So I started to leave on foot. And as I turned to leave on foot, I could hear her screaming at him then, hurry up, get your rig, go get her. She's going to the neighbors. The neighbors were about 200 yards away. So I started to run. And I ran to the neighbors. And when I got to the door, pounded on the door. No one was home, of course. but I could hear him start his vehicle. Their residence was up a hill, so you could hear everything. I could hear every word they were saying. I could hear the engine start. I could hear them come down the hill. And so I ran into the bushes and hid where I could see him come down the hill, come out onto the county road, drive down the road to a little turnaround, come back very slowly looking for me, and then back up to their residence. I stayed hidden until the deputies came to help me, thank heavens. And again, it was rural, and we're looking at about 20 to 30 minutes. When they did arrive, this woman was arrested and taken to jail for assault on a public safety officer, which is a Class C felony and holds a 14-day mandatory jail time if you're convicted of the crime. Literally 5 minutes before the hearing, before it went to court, the judge made a determination that animal control officers did not fall under the definition of public safety officers. He threw that charge out, and she was tried on a lesser charge of merely a Class A misdemeanor. That decision and that event sent a terrible message to the community, not only in the way they can treat us, and it sent a terrible message to other animal control officers in the whole state of Oregon. Senate Bill 487 just simply adds animal control officers to the definition of public safety officer as it pertains to officers as assault victims. It's extremely important for every single animal control officer in our state to have that extra protection. We deserve it. We're out there, and it's not fun a lot of the times. I really appreciate your consideration of this. I would also like to thank Senator Metzger for actually knocking on my door, listening to what I had to say, and taking action. I'm just totally impressed. This is my first experience, and I'm absolutely impressed with the whole situation. I'd also like to thank you for giving me this opportunity, and if you have any questions that I might be able to answer, I'm happy to try.
All right. Thank you very much, Senator Burry.
I'm surprised you weren't afraid to open your door.
Pardon?
I'm surprised you weren't afraid to open your door when Senator Metzger came to call.
Well, I don't know if he remembers, but I opened it, but I didn't let him in. I was still suffering quite a bit at that point, you know. And we talked like this, and finally I came outside, so I thought maybe it was okay.
I do have to ask you, there are a number of crimes that I could identify just from your rendition. What mm-hmm. happened to the woman who assaulted you?
I am just totally ashamed and sad to say that a jury let her off because they felt that, yeah, it's a little emotional for me. This was a terrible thing. I have suffered post-traumatic stress syndrome. I can hardly do my job any longer. They let her off because they felt that there wasn't enough evidence to prove that she did that on purpose, that she didn't hit me on purpose, that she didn't try to keep me up there on purpose, that she didn't keep my vehicle on purpose, you know. So that's where I'm at, and I'm hoping you can help us all.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Susan Russell.
Good morning, members of the committee. Chairman, Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm here in opposition to Senate Bill 487. While we appreciate the concerns that have been raised here today, we believe that the definition of public safety officer is adequately expansive and should not be further enlarged. Thank you.
Thank you very much. James Doerr, I'm sorry, Senator McGill.
I just had a question, if I could, please.
Sure.
Does expanding the definition of animal control officer, as this bill proposes, have any other ramifications that haven't been explained here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I don't believe so. It would simply expand by including that category of professionals within the definition of a public safety officer, which is a Class C felony and requires a mandatory jail sentence.
Senator Ferrioli, unless if you're finished.
I am finished.
Yeah, we're not amending the aggravated murder statutes.
Mr. Chairman, I seem to remember in the recent legislative session that we increased the penalty for assaulting an official at a sporting event. So we made that a higher set of penalties, and I just wondered if the opponent of the bill would care to I try to characterize the relative level of danger in the case where we have protected the sporting official and would not protect a public safety officer who faces the possibility of injury every day on the job.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Ferriol, our concern is that at some point a line needs to be drawn between categories, and our concern is that by expanding the definitions, this has been expanded last session as well to include other definitions of officers, and simply at some point a definition needs to stop with the fear that otherwise it will be continuously expanding. So with respect to the sports official, I wasn't I don't think I testified on that provision. I'm not sure in what context that was, if that was expanding.
It was to keep them from being assaulted, Mr. Chairman, which is unfortunately obviously something that needed at the time.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Ferriol, that may be, I'm not familiar with the context in which that arose.
All right. Thank you, Susan. Appreciate your testimony. Stephen Doerr. I'm sorry. James Doerr. Forgive me. Assaulting the legislators.
Separate
schedule. Doerr, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is James Doerr, and I'm employed by the Albany Police Department as a code enforcement specialist. That job entails that I do animal control for the city of Albany. I investigate and enforce animal control issues such as abuse and neglect, dogs and animals running at large, barking dogs, public nuisance animals. I deal in the realm of anything from cats up to horses, cattle, the gamut. I have been doing that job for approximately 7 years. One thing I've noticed in my 7 years of employment is I deal with the exact same people that the police officers do. I deal with gang members, drug dealers, thieves, murderers, robbers, the same exact people. And yet we are considered civilian employees, and in the case of assaults, we are of a lower stature. I have been involved in search warrants of drug houses. Well, they've had me go along because there's been a gentleman that has a pit bull guarding his house. And they want me to go in there, grab the dog, and pull it outside so they don't get bit. unfortunately, that's the nature of this job. Animal control officers throughout the state of Oregon, it's a rewarding job, but it's not a very fun job. We see the worst of people and the best of people. Most of the citizens are normal, upstanding, quality people, but there are the other sort. If I might go over real quick, drug dealers. They like to use pit bulls and Rottweilers to guard their stash in their house. Gang members. They use pit bulls, Rottweilers, and Crested Canarios as a status symbol. For those who don't know, Crested Canario is the one that killed Diane Whipple down in San Francisco. That dog was owned by a white supremacist gang member. There are people who raise pit bulls for fighting. They hold their matches in hidden arenas and basements and garages. We always get abuse and neglect complaints against them because they see the dogs in the backyard. They've got open sores, cuts, wounds. Normally, the people who raise pit bulls are not the most friendliest people in the world. I'm coming and knocking on their door saying, sorry, I need to take your dog or dogs because they're injured and I'm concerned for them. Their response is not always, well, yeah, go ahead and take it. Animal owners are very passionate when it comes to their pets. You can see that by going to Petco or PetSmart and you see all the different things that are available. If I go in there and say, sir, ma'am, you're abusing your dog. I feel that you are hitting it inappropriately, and I'm taking your dog. They're not very happy with us. There have been cases where a coworker of mine from Douglas County, he went to go talk to somebody about an abuse case, and they stuck a shotgun underneath his chin. And they said, leave now or you will die. I mean, that's the bottom line. I've had occasions where I've gone to residences on my job. I do it by myself. I don't carry any defensive weapons. I don't carry body armor. I have learned later that the house is flagged in our computer system as a two-officer response. Okay, two officers have to go minimum, and I'm there by myself. Several members of my agency, several police officers, have told me they would not do my job for any amount of money, period, end of discussion.
All right, hang on just a second. We're going to do a little work session. Senate Bill 47.
Senate Bill 47, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ferry only moves
Senate
Bill 487 be sent to the floor of the Senate. Please pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. This is ordered. Who wants to carry it? Senator Ferry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Any members?
Apologize for cutting you off there, but you probably want the bill more than you want to talk.
That's right.
Thank you very much. All right, we're going to do a public hearing then on Senate Bill 304. I understand all of the parties are in essence in agreement on this, including the Oregon Defense Lawyers Association. So, Karen Brazeau, you signed up on the line here. So, Karen, why don't you come up and tell us why you're. Where is she?
She's off
gone.
The line now.
She's off the line.
Sure, she's out in the hallway.
Out in the hallway. Karen, you're up.
And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, while Ms. Brazeau is coming up, Senate Bill 304 would allow, in a case where the youth and the state stipulate to waiver to adult court, would allow that to happen in a circumstance rather than just the ones where they're mentioned Class A or B, Class Felony, would allowable in any felony or any misdemeanor.
All right.
If the parties agree.
Right. If both parties agree.
Chair Menace and members of the committee, my name is Karen Brazeau. I'm the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. And when I signed up to testify today, I kind of signed somewhere in between. And I signed up last after the district attorneys. So I'm surprised to be called first. And since I signed up in the middle of the road there, I've had numerous conversations with the district attorneys in the room, and they have allayed some of my concerns. And primarily, I just want to go on record that the intent of the bill, as I understand it, is not to place more waived youth into the care and custody of the youth authority. My concern is that there is a statute on the books, 420 or 419A010, that is, I'm sorry, I quoted the wrong statute, 420011, that is a little bit confusing about placement of waived youth into the youth authority. And because this proposed amendment clearly allows for many more types of broadens the net around waived youth, I wanted to make it clear that the intent was not to increase the number or the type of waived youth who would be placed into the youth authority. And that might make more sense after you've heard testimony from the proponents of the bill about why they are putting the bill forward.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it. Mr. Berry and Doug Harkle-Rose, whoever else you want to bring
here. Yes, we can bring all of the DAs and deputies here at the same time and move it quickly.
Right. Redeem the time for me, please.
Good morning, Chairman Minnis and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be heard on this bill. Might begin by having the people at the table introduce themselves, if that's all right.
Great, for the record, Chair.
Doug Harkle Road, Lane County District Attorney.
Good morning, Scott Heiser, Benton County District Attorney.
Sean Fisher, Polk County District Attorney.
Amy Holmes, State Representative.
And I'm Brad Berry, Yamhill County District Attorney. I also serve currently as Vice President of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I chair their legislative committee. And Senate Bill 304 is one of our top priorities this session. If I can just briefly explain what it does, what the bill itself does, kind of its origin, and then how we see that it will accomplish the goals that we're after. And I'll try and be brief. I know we're running kind of long this morning. First of all, in its simplest terms, Senate Bill 304 would, by agreement of the parties, that includes the state and the youth, authorize the waiver of any offense from for a 15, 16, or 17-year-old from juvenile court to adult court. It adds flexibility in dealing with these older youth, especially those who are potentially facing Measure 11 charges. And again, it would allow waiver on any offense. Currently, the waiver statutes, as they were changed, I think it was about 8 years ago when there was a total redoing of the juvenile law, basically the juvenile law provisions, used to be called remand. And through that process, the waiver really was reduced to what could be waived into adult court. And many of those offenses are Measure 11 offenses. Kind of the genesis of this bill, if I can explain how this happens. In my county, as I think with most counties, we are very deliberate. We've created a very deliberate process, a thoughtful and comprehensive process in reviewing offenses where youth have committed Measure 11 offenses. We look at those to, in regards to the facts of the case, to the youth's history. We get victim input. In my county, we get law enforcement and juvenile probation officer input, and we review alternatives to handling the case as a Measure 11 offense. It's not uncommon that we get in a position where Measure 11 just doesn't seem like it's exactly where we want to go, but we're limited on alternatives because of the inability to waive on other offenses for these older youth. We recognize that the juvenile system, although it has the authority to monitor and track these youth after age 18, it is, in my experience, and I think those sitting at the table with me, that it is very common that once these youth turn 18, that they are moved outside of the monitoring by the juvenile department. In other words, their probations are terminated at that point, and they continue to concentrate on other youth who are younger. It is also not uncommon in my experience that these older youth will continue to have treatment needs or other monitoring needs that then will not be met. We've noticed that also on attempting to waive youth or to handle youth who have committed Measure 11 offenses, many of the alternatives we may go to will apply against the county's cap. I'm going to guess you're not familiar with that term. There are two types of offenses that can be committed to the Oregon Youth Authority. Those, for without getting into great detail, that are A and B felonies go to Oregon Youth Authority, and Measure 11 youth go to the Oregon Youth Authority, and don't count against the county's cap. But other youth, for example, who may have committed burglaries or other lower-level offenses that have typically had repeated offenses and are ultimately committed to the Oregon Youth Authority, count against a cap. In other words, there are only so many beds that each county has that they can put these youth into at McLaren, for example. My county, Yamhill County, had 19 beds until the recent reductions, and we're currently down to 11. So one of the alternatives with these older youth, if we can find an appropriate place to go, an agreement between both sides, is waiving them to adult court, and then they're handled like adults for the sense of probation, for supervision, and our alternatives then come into the adult system rather than applying against that cap in the youth, in the juvenile system.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, could you tell me what happens if you go over your cap? Where do you put those children?
Currently, as I understand the system, if you are at your cap, say we are at our 11 beds, the youth authority won't take those youth. There may be some discussion. I think you can occasionally go over a bed or two if there's sufficient room. But what will happen in my county is they will find alternatives where it might be best that we want that youth in a very supervised facility such as McLaren, but they may have to look at out-of-home placement for these youth, foster care alternatives within the community, until you back somebody out. It kind of reminds me of the of before when we had the parole board, before the sentencing guidelines and the prisons were all full. If somebody came in the front door, somebody had to go out the back door. And the OIA basically requires the counties to manage their own offender population under the cap. and to make those decisions.
Thank you.
The goal here is to give increased flexibility, especially in cases where these youth have committed Measure 11 offenses. We recognize that oftentimes treatment cannot be accomplished within the time frame typically allotted to these youth in the juvenile system, and that treatment can be accomplished while leaving these youth within the community. We also recognize that, I think I said treatment can go beyond the 18th birthday. I'm prepared to kind of give you some examples of where we get caught between a rock and a hard place, or answer questions, whatever is your preference.
Let's just answer the issue that Ms. Brazeau raised with respect to intent, not committing more.
District Attorney Harkerode and I, as well as District Attorney Heiser, met with her and talked with her about that. Typically, Mr. Chair, these the offenses that we see, which we would want to use or have the ability to use, are not offenses that we would expect to go to OYA anyway. They might, in fact, be misdemeanors that we intend to monitor or treat within the community. And then these youth, if they got a probation violation, for example, and they're over 16, would continue to be housed in the jail once they're 16 if they'd had some sanction imposed. The others, where it is a little more difficult, if you have, for example, and I'm excluding the 15-year-olds, and I'll come back to that in a moment, a 16 or 17-year-old who technically could be charged with a Measure 11 manslaughter case, and we think appropriately it could be handled as a criminally negligent homicide, which is not a waivable offense today, you could agree to do that, then they would end up in the with the Department of Corrections. And they may, in fact, be housed at OYA until at least their 18th birthday. However, if the alternative was Measure 11, they would end up at OYA for a much longer period of time. In short, other than 15-year-olds, I don't think this will have a significant impact on OYA. And beyond that, it's not really our intent to expand the type of youth or the criteria for youth who could be committed to OYA beyond what it is today. Now, I did omit talking about 15-year-olds. There may be a small number of 15-year-olds that commit a Measure 11 offense that we would want to bring out of Measure 11 and waive into adult court, and there may be a small number there that, in fact, couldn't end up at OYA. I would think it's a much greater likelihood that they would be dealt with locally by design.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Russell, any comments on this bill?
Susan Russell, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we support this bill for the reasons set forth. There are a number of Measure 11 offenses, for example, where there is no lesser included, for example, kidnapping second degree, but the court is now authorized to waive the youth into adult court as a resolution. We are happy to see that it's by stipulation only of both the youth and the state, and believe that it would allow for the parties to fashion a remedy that would be appropriate to the facts of the case, and therefore support this bill.
All right. Thank you very much. Work session, Senate Bill 304.
Chair.
Senator Brake.
I move Senate Bill 304 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Brake moves Senate Bill 304 unamended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. No order. Senator.
Thank you very much.
Chair Nolan, would you carry this bill?
I will, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. And is the committee okay if we go over a few minutes this morning, or do we have commitments that are going to
go for it?
I need to check in my office.
All right. If we could, I want to give some time to Attorney General to move into public hearing on Senate Bill 617. And Connie?
Thank you very much, Chair Minnis and members. For the record, I'm Attorney General Hardy Myers, and I appreciate the opportunity to present some opening comments as you begin your consideration of Senate Bill 617. I'm appearing this morning in my capacity as Chair of the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force, which was created in 2002 and which is the sponsoring, which is the sponsor of Senate Bill 617. Mr. Chair, if I could inquire at the outset, I know your normal adjournment time would be 10, and I, in order to keep you as close to that as possible, what I propose to do is to very much compress my introductory remarks and allow, there are three or four other members of the task force, particularly some of whom are here, some inconvenience, I'd be very appreciative if I would have the chance to get their testimony into the record, if if Ms. Gallagher and I could be invited to come back at a second hearing,
that's
we will
fine.
Have some amendments as well, Mr. Chair.
You will have amendments?
Yes.
All right, that's fine. Why don't we do that then?
The task force was formed, Chair Minnis and members, to address an issue that has been of serious concern to crime victims in Oregon for many years. The Oregon Constitution purports to vest crime victims with a right to prompt restitution. But that constitutional commitment we are falling far short of meeting. Very briefly, under current law, when a person is convicted of a crime or a violation that results in pecuniary damages, the court, in addition to any other sentence, may order that the offender make restitution to the victim. But the law, the current statutory law, further provides that in making that decision, whether to order restitution or not, or full restitution or less than full, the court is to take into account the financial resources of the defendant and the burden that payment of restitution will impose, taking into account the other obligations of the defendant. Now, the effect of this present statutory scheme is that a significant number of crime victims who have suffered pecuniary loss are being left without any restitution judgment whatsoever. Our Crime Victims Assistance Section recently examined 1,364 claims in which the section paid money, paid out compensation money under the state compensation structure. And we found that of those 1,364 claims, about 79%, or 1,077, did not have any restitution ordered whatsoever. 79%. I think it's also worth quickly noting that in a recent statewide crime victims needs assessment that the Department of Justice conducted, 60% of the responding victims indicated they believe that their right to restitution was not being enforced by the state of Oregon. So what this measure in substance proposes to do, Mr. Chair and members, is to provide that if a court finds that a person convicted of a crime or violation has caused pecuniary damages, based on evidence presented by the district attorney, the court must enter a judgment that the defendant pay a specific amount of restitution that equals the full amount of the victim's damages, or enter a judgment that the defendant must pay such amount or pay full restitution, and with the specific amount of the restitution to be determined within a later specified time period. Now, the bill also provides that while the judgments are due and payable when the amount of restitution is entered, the court or other supervisory authority may establish a payment schedule taking into account the financial resources of the defendant and the burden that restitution payments will impose. So in short, the bill proposes a fundamental change in Oregon policy by which restitution becomes a mandate in every case that meets the statutory description, and the financial resources of the defendant, rather than a determinant of whether restitution will be ordered at all, becomes a determinant of how the restitution judgment will be paid. And the bill also makes a parallel change, Chair Menace and members, for the juvenile court system. It being our belief that increased accountability, offender accountability for both adult and youth offenders is a worthwhile goal of Oregon policy and is essential not only to, I think, the vindication of the victim's rights, but also to the proper rehabilitation of offenders, adult and youth. Mr. Chair, members, that is a very brief overview of the basic substance policy thrust of the bill. Ms. Gallagher would have some further comments too, but I believe I would invite her, if she could, to defer those till we might come back with our amendments. And if I could, Mr. Chair, we have three or four other task force members who I'd like to ask to be recognized for their testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. If you could then go ahead and call those persons up and we'll hear from them.
Let's see, Diane Ray, Arwin Bird, Steve is here, and
Helen
Bradley.
Helen Smith.
Helen Smith, excuse me, from Multnomah County DA's office.
Oh,
Senator Brown. Senator Brown, thank you for gracing us with your presence today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Senator Kate Brown. Thanks for hearing Senate Bill 617. As you know, I represent Southeast Portland, a little bit of Northeast Portland, and all of Milwaukee, Senate District 21. The product before you is from Attorney General Hardy Myers' Restitution Task Force, and I'd like to thank the members of the task force along with the Attorney General and their staff for all of their hard work on this particular bill as well as the other issues that the task force addressed. There's a number of folks here, Mr. Chair. I would just like to say that I think this bill is extremely important. I think it makes offenders accountable to their victims. It requires the district attorney to present to the court evidence of the amount of injury and damage to a person and ask the court to enter a judgment for the full amount of the victim's pecuniary damages. I anticipate we're going to see a number of amendments. I just think it's important to victims throughout Oregon, and I ask that you support the bill and look forward to working with you as we amend it and bring it to the Senate floor. So, thanks.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate your testimony. Senator Burdick.
Just very briefly, can you say what the amendments are going to do? Or
I have not been working on the amendments, Madam Vice Chair, Mr. Chair, so I do not know.
All right. Who's first?
I'll go first. Good morning. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Arwen Bird. I'm the Executive Director of SAFE, Survivors Advocating for an Effective System. We're a member-driven organization of crime survivors who seek a system of restorative justice. I am also a member of the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force. I'm here today because SAFE believes that restitution is one of the cornerstones of a truly effective justice system. Restitution from offenders acknowledges the harm that was done. More profoundly, it represents responsibility for the injury caused by the crime, regardless of whether the damage was physical or emotional. Our current criminal justice system is impersonal. Sometimes this is necessary. In most cases, the course of events amount to an elaborate drama in which the primary players are lawyers. What might have been begun as a very personal crime, an assault, a rape, a burglary, becomes another court case, the State versus John Doe. Throughout the process, punishment of the offender is the focus. Survivors are guaranteed the right to participate and have their voices heard, but the harm that was done to them is not the focus of the process. Very little is required that would indicate responsibility on the part of the offender. This bill represents important progress for our criminal justice system. By requiring that the full amount of restitution be paid, the state will shift the focus of the system back toward the harm that was done. This is an important step toward a restorative justice system for both survivors and defendants. My interest in this issue and criminal justice reform generally stems from the fact that I was paralyzed by a drunk driver 10 years ago. At the time of the sentencing for the man who hit my sister and me, our hospital bills exceeded $300,000. Insurance only covered a portion of that bill, leaving $115,000 in costs that were ordered for his restitution. We have only recovered a fraction of that total. I won't belabor the details, but it has been 10 years of an uphill struggle, and there is no end in sight for me and my family. Needless to say, we are frustrated by a system that is not empowered to help get restitution to crime survivors. The amount of restitution that we are owed is unusual, but sadly, the fact that we have not been paid is very common. Restitution should not impair a defendant's ability to live a normal life, nor should it impair his or her ability to engage in his community after serving his sentence. It must simply be an acknowledgement of the harm that was done. We strongly support the fact that the payment schedule for a defendant be determined by their ability to pay. We also agree that the burden that payment of restitution will impose be considered. Otherwise, restitution becomes more of a punishment rather than an acknowledgement of responsibility. Thank you for your time today. Restitution reform is not only near and dear to me, but the many survivors that I have interviewed about this issue, most of whom are not receiving restitution for their injury.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Thanks for coming this morning, Arwen.
The person who was responsible, the drunk driver, do you know, do they have a job? Does this person have the ability to pay restitution?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, my case is unusual in that he owns multiple cars, was part owner of a construction company, and does have the means to pay. My case kind of highlights some of the problems with the system, and that he was an offender who had the means, but the state, for whatever reason, has not pursued him. Currently, he's declared bankruptcy, and so we're going to have to wait until the bankruptcy is over before we can start collecting again.
Bankruptcy does not remove this debt, does it?
That's correct.
Doesn't discharge the debt. Okay, thank you.
Steve?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, and members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon, and we are here to testify in support of Senate Bill 617. Crime Victims United was honored to be asked by Attorney General Myers to be a part of the Restitution Reform Task Force, and we see this as an important first step in fulfilling the promise of restitution to victims. In 1986, ballot measure 10 was put on the ballot by Crime Victims United, which gave statutory provisions for crime victims, including restitution. In 1996, ballot measure number 40 was put on the ballot by Crime Victims United to give constitutional rights to crime victims, which included restitution. That was thrown out by the courts, as you'll recall, by the now infamous Armada decision, which was not because the bill was unconstitutional, but because it was technicality. This legislative body was good enough to re-refer to the voters, and once again was passed in 1999 as a constitutional right of crime victims. The problem is this. It's an empty promise. An empty promise. But as Bird mentioned, we've got crime victims all over the state who are asked why, when they suffer a loss, that the main thrust of this bill is that the full loss be pursued, not a portion of that loss. So we ask you to help us fulfill this promise, and also I will back up for a minute. In 1996, the voters also passed ballot measure 26, which was referred by this body. And in ballot measure 26, it said, foundations for principles of criminal law. Laws for the punishment of crimes should be founded on these principles: protection of society, personal responsibility and accountability for one's actions, and reformation. By the studies done by the Portland State in their Oregon Crime Victims Needs Assessment, offender accountability was the number one issue. And I would refer you to this constitutional amendment that the people passed. This is what you should look at every time you look into criminal law and passing a new statute around issues of criminal law, be it punishment, be it restitution, whatever it is. Look to Article 1, Section 15. Thank you very much for your time, and I take any questions you might have.
Any questions of Mr. Bill? There are none. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Helen Smith, Chief Deputy District Attorney, Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I forwarded to you moments ago a letter from the District Attorney, Mike Schrunk, who was a member of this task force over the last several months. We see the issues raised by Ms. Bird and Mr. Dole every day in our practice, victims confused as to why the court is not making them whole, or at least attempting to make them whole. We also see difficulty for the judges in having to try and guess how much any particular offender is able to pay, basically at the moment that offender is before the judge, when in fact this judgment lasts for 20 years, and they're having to also guess out into the future how much this person will be able to pay. And as you can imagine, at the moment that the person is before the judge, being an offender, oftentimes being in custody, the ability to pay is less than what it might be 5, 10, 20 years hence. In speaking with our circuit court administrator, I was advised that it's certainly not unusual to have title companies come in years later as this offender is trying to buy a home and come in to pay off the judgment in full. That doesn't mean that the judgment as ordered originally covered the victim's full losses, but what it does show us is that offenders do become able to pay. Certainly not 100% of them, but a number of them do. This bill takes the guesswork out of the process for the judge, and it puts victims in the place of at least having an opportunity to be made whole. And it's for that reason that we support Senate Bill 617. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Diane Reak, I'd be glad to come back if you're out of time. I could come back and testify with the
committee. Your tolerance? Yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
You have an appointment.
The subject of the amendments is, I think, most interesting, and I gather that they're not prepared at this point.
I'm assuming that's the case. Mr. Myers?
Chairman, preferably Hardy Myers, Attorney General. The amendments have been worked to address some procedural administrative concerns raised by the Judicial Department. I believe they have all been agreed to. They do not affect the basic policy thrust of the bill, but they are directed more toward the, if you will, the kind of the machinery of the operation of it. And I'm sorry that they aren't ready today, but we just finished working through the discussions with the Judicial Department. I think it was actually yesterday. So they would be ready, I think, within a week or two for your consideration. But again, they don't affect the basic policy direction that you're invited to take by the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I think the policy issue is persuasive. At this point, I think I at least am only interested in learning how to amend the bill with to make the machinery operate.
All right. Well, and Diane, if you don't mind, we skip over your testimony for now. And I've got Susan Russell, and he's signed up against the bill. Susan, is your testimony in opposition lengthy, or is it?
2 minutes.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I obviously we're running out of time. I am interested in exploring the issue a little bit further, probably on a different day, as to how the committee balanced the public interest in restitution with the interest of the offender to get on with their life after it's been deemed that they paid their debt to society. I find that an interesting issue, and I'd like to explore it at some point. But I just wanted to.
Okay. Well, it's clear the bill has to come back at some point with amendments, so I think we'll schedule some additional time to do that, and Susan will allow you to come back. Why don't you come up and just tell us if you can, because I don't know whether or not your testimony would affect any of the amendments at this point, so let's see if we get a sense for what your opposition is.
Susan Russell, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we're here in opposition to Senate Bill 617 as it's currently drafted. We appreciate the concerns that are raised here, and we support the victim's right to obtain restitution in criminal cases. But our concern is that we believe that the judges should continue to have some discretion in awarding restitution when there are exceptional circumstances, and there are exceptional circumstances. I think that when we're talking about 79% of cases having no restitution, there is a problem. But we have a number of people that are in the criminal justice system that are incapable of working and will never be capable of working and making any kind of dent in restitution, and particularly when we're talking about significant restitutions. We have a significant number of people that have sort of been pushed from the mental health system into the criminal system, and we see that this is probably going to expand more when we take into account all the cuts that are happening in social services. So you have clients that are schizophrenic or serious bipolar disorders that are in the criminal justice system that will resolve their cases sometimes by a plea to a lesser offense. There's really nowhere for these people to be cared for. They're on SSI and permanent disability. I'll give you one example of a case, because I know we are limited in time, where restitution was reduced by the court. It was an individual with schizophrenia who lived in a sort of an assisted living building, set a fire, a small fire in his room, because he believed that the CIA can only come and evacuate him if he destroyed all evidence of his DNA. The water system went on, the sprinkler system, because it was that kind of facility that had these kind of ongoing problems, because of the disabilities, mental disabilities, and others of the people who resided there. There was a huge amount, $20,000, $30,000 worth of damage to this facility because of the water damage. The court, and the person was on permanent disability, had numerous problems and was never going to get over those permanent psychological problems and mental illness problems. The court ordered a very small amount of restitution, which was sort of the deductible that the building was out. And sometimes in these cases, what we'll see when someone is challenged in these situations, that the court imposes the out-of-pocket expenses of the victim, but will reduce or not award the insurance company part of the restitution. And so we believe strongly that the courts need to continue to have some ability to look at those exceptional circumstances where a defendant cannot pay and is living on a very minimal Social Security or SSI or disability benefit.
All right. Is that that's the primary concern?
That's our primary concern. I think there are other issues that aren't addressed by the bill, and I think that's a big one as well that's already been mentioned too, is that this bill doesn't address helping victims get the restitution payments once they've been ordered by the court. And there are obviously a lot of those that go unpaid. And just one final point, if I can just quickly spit out, is that we're also concerned that probation not be extended, which is an expensive service that the state provides and is really one where we're having cuts all over the place, should be really not sort of a collection agency function, but providing services to the defendant rehabilitation. So we would not like to see this bill being a sort of a basis for extending probation where all that remains is for the defendant to make payments.
Ms. Russell, I would appreciate it if you would reduce your objections to writing and forwarding them to the Attorney General's office. Either accommodate or at least answer your concerns.
And I'd be happy to do that. Thank you.
That's possible. The task force. All right. With that, thank you, committee, for your indulgence, and we're here.